G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Now let's get to Adam White, who's, you know good things have happened to one of his teams when you wake up and you click on the Zoom and you see him wearing club apparel, Joe Pignataro style, down the line. Adam White, good morning to you.
Good morning, Daniel. I am completely back in love. I've fallen back in love with my football team, my Premier League soccer team, because not only did they win 5-2 overnight, having been down 1-0, but a favourite son has returned, Gareth Bale. We talked about it late last week. It has happened. He has returned to Tottenham. So it's exciting times. And as you said, it's quite warm this morning. No reason to put the heater on. No reason for a hoodie or a jumper situation. So away we go.
So explain to me. Stand by. Hold that, and we'll get to that. Adam Rabanaskas joins us on a Monday morning. He's the Bombers champion and these days manager to the Stars, a premiership player, and, of course, the person which whom the Essendon Football Club named their most courageous player at in their award ceremony at the end of season, which was awarded across the weekend, in fact, yesterday at the Bombers. And he joins us again. Rama, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, it's interesting. It's very interesting to see Whitey up and about. You know, Gareth Bale, the saviour, as he says, is back at the club. I'm just not sure about that. They'll find a way to muck it up still, Tottenham.
I'm sure they will.
Didn't I see that PSG were after one of their guns? Didn't I see that across the weekend?
Yeah, they can have Dele Alli. That's fine. I'm happy. That doesn't bother me. We've got Gareth back.
So I need to find out a point of distinction here. What's the difference with Joey Pignataro wearing Collingwood apparel to you wearing Tottenham apparel? I need to know the difference.
It's simple. It's simple. Very simple. Firstly, this is a T-shirt type setup that can be worn with a jean or a short. You can't wear a sleeveless jumper with jeans or a short. I'd describe that as more an ochre type setup to be wearing an AFL jersey. Anything over the age of 16, I've said that before. So I feel there's a clear difference. And also, it's come from overseas, so it's a bit unique as well.
Doesn't matter. I'm putting you in the same category. You are
no chance.
Flog. That's what you've called Joey before, and now it's been thrown back at you in the face.
I tend to agree with Whitey.
I agree with you, Whitey, on Joey. 16, or no one-day international shirt, Australian one-day international shirt, over the age of 16 either. That's
what
a simple fact. It's a rule.
You bought it overseas?
No, if it was an international shirt, I'd be less worried about it. So if you were wearing an IPL shirt or a county cricket shirt, not a white one, like a one-day shirt, a bit different. Maybe an England one-day international shirt, but not an Australian one.
No, I think you're losing your argument here. You're both losing your argument.
I think Joey's okay. I think Joey's okay because he looks under 16.
Yeah, correct. He would not purchase an adult jumper garment either. It would be a youth size.
Joey, correct. This is workplace harassment. Joey, I'm here for it. I will witness it. I'll write a letter to HR, just CC me in the email, and I will back you up with this harassment that's going on there at the moment. If Joey buys a Collingwood supporter jumper overseas, does it make it okay?
No, it doesn't. No.
Well, you just said it comes from overseas, so it makes a difference.
Yeah, but no, it's an overseas garment.
It's not really. It's
representative of a team from overseas.
I'm just checking the criteria. It's important.
I don't think I'd wear a Melbourne Victory one.
Do you know the other problem here, Huff?
Yes.
The other problem is that Whitey's very confused with his AFL team. Like the Fitzroy, obviously, that was a sad day. He's still sort of, there's still tears rolling down his eyes from that. Yeah. Then he tends to like Essendon at times. Tends to like Hawthorn at times. He's a very confused individual.
And the great thing is that I've now got Melbourne to support in the finals because obviously Melbourne made the eight. The form ladder said it would.
It would.
It did. We've got a week off, and then we can support Melbourne in the finals.
Freshen up, go Dees.
It's a great day.
We did our bit. The formulator did its bit.
How do you think they'll go in the finals half? Because no, I think they're probably a real chance.
No, I think they might struggle this year. They might struggle, the poor old D's, going any further in the competition after what happened on the weekend. They might struggle. Poor old D's, it's all over for them. It's all over.
They did what they had to do.
They sit there and lament what might have been to hell and back, is what they told us in the pre-season, to hell and back. Well, back is sort of in the middle of the table somewhere.
They are losers.
Oh, Donald, that's
the two games that stick out, Whitey? The two games that stick out for Melbourne?
Oh, well, there's only one that really stands out for me, and that is the Sydney game. Mm. I think if you look back at them now, it was something that Max Gawn said to us last week, which I really appreciate his honesty, but I'm still finding it hard to come to terms with, was that they went away from how they wanted to play in those two games in Cairns because of the conditions. And they went to a more defensive type setup to play those two games. And they realised after those two games that they'd done the wrong thing. And they went back to their more attacking ways, which we saw against Essendon. And clearly they're still not playing as well as what they would want to be. They become a watch next year, don't they? Because they'll go one of two ways, I think.
Possibly. Well, who knows? Look, seriously, I actually don't know what to do with Melbourne, so I might just leave him over there for a bit. Just not worrying about it for another couple of months.
I don't think I'll be getting emotionally involved in Melbourne again next year. I think I've learnt my lesson.
Those teams in the middle of the ladder, they're a fascinating conversation because if you look at, obviously, Melbourne, yep, you're absolutely correct there, half. No idea what to do with them next year. GWS, what do you do with GWS? It's... Carlton, no. I think it's clear what they need. They need another midfielder or two. Fremantle look terrific in the back end of the back part of the season, what they're doing with their football. Essendon, got no idea what they do.
There's a few of those clubs, though. They're just there that... Maybe they are what they are, and they're just average. Giants are a bit different because of what they've done in three consecutive years, but the teams like Melbourne and Essendon and... I think there's probably... We said it at the start of this year, we said it at the start of last year, there's six or eight teams that sort of sit between sort of 5 and 12 on the ladder, and apart from Port Adelaide, who sort of pushed themselves out of that sort of frustrating, inconsistent team, there's still a lot that's still sitting in that area.
But you can continue on with this conversation. Like, Gold Coast, I think, looks promising, what's happening there.
I'm not buying Gold Coast.
Oh, look, that was terrible. That was terrible yesterday, but I think Gold Coast this year... have improved. Yep, they've done that. They've done that
have
three
they?
Years in a row now. What do Hawthorn do? Did they just tip the whole thing on its head?
Yep.
Sydney look promising with their kids
Sydney
coming through.
Good. They're the ones I want to be backing. I want shares in Sydney. John Longmire's turned them around really quickly, and not just from a personnel perspective, Ramon, but the way they play it. Totally different brand of footy they're playing at the moment. They should have won that game yesterday against Geelong. We'll talk more about it after 7, but they should have won that game against Geelong.
But then what happens if Collingwood lose tonight, finish 8th, come up against West Coast in the first week, and then they're out the first week of the finals?
Yeah, I think, Rama, the most interesting thing out of this discussion, and we'll be having it a lot in over the next period of time, is which teams blow themselves up over the off-season and kind of start again or sort of reset, and which teams go, nah, we're happy with where we are, we'll build. And then the other thing also is which teams will go, you know what, this is such a unique year, we're kind of ignoring what happened and we'll just go again next year. There's sort of three ways of looking at it. And I don't know, and teams like Hawthorn and Essendon and the Giants are the three teams for me, and maybe Collingwood if they were to lose their first final. I don't think so with Collingwood. But those other teams I mentioned, it is going to be fascinating to see what they do. Because we kind of know that Melbourne thinks that their list is okay. They might add to it a little bit.
Yep.
But teams like Essendon, Hawthorn and the Giants, they're the teams for me. I'm going to be fascinated to see what they do.
This reset, reload, rebuild is a really interesting conversation. I think if you look at Port Adelaide, for example, you know, they're a chance, obviously, to finish on the top of the ladder. They basically went backwards for one season, which was still a very promising season, to go forwards this season the way they have.
Yeah. And so they did that largely.
That, the rebuild model now, I don't think clubs support groups are patient enough to go down the bottom of the ladder for 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, the difference with the Port Adelaide scenario was that they got it right, almost better than they even expected themselves with what they did. But largely, and this is the interesting sort of test case for me with Essendon, that largely it was on the back of one player. So Chad Wingard left, it gave them another pick inside 10. Pittard left as well, but ultimately it got them 3 or 4 picks inside 25 with one player going. Now, the situation with Essendon, I think he's much the same. If Joe Danaher goes, do they keep the pick and have 2 picks inside 10 and then sort of have a mini renovation, if you like? Or do they trade that pick and essentially swap a player for a player of equal ability to Danaher? Or do they trade both of those picks and say, well, we're in it for the now. Let's go for the now with the older players. Because I've got the feeling that if Danaher goes and they get a pick for him, I reckon other senior players will go as well because they'll feel that they are taking that step back to reset, focus on the younger players under a new coach, and that will be what they'll do. So Essendon's future may hinge on what Joe Danaher decides.
Well, they're not good enough anyway at the moment, so what's that really going to matter? If that's their mindset, I think they're all delusional. Because they're not good enough anyway. Him being there or not is not going to make the difference for them being a premiership winning or premiership tilt team, surely.
Yeah, I'm of a different opinion to all this. I want him to stay and I hope he stays, but I think their issue lies with getting players out on the park consistently. You don't see a consistent Essendon lineup ever out there. And That's the issue. That's the issue that I continue to see at the Bombers for the last 3, 4, 5 years. They've never had any resemblance of a team even close to their best 18 players.
We'll see.
It hurts. That hurts. You coach, obviously, the highest level possible of women's football. You know if you're missing your 3, 4, 5 players consistently, it's almost impossible. It's impossible to have any sort of consistency.
That's true, but I'd find a way to master coach something, engineer something. Except on grand final day when you're out playing comprehensively.
The key word to that is he would engineer. He would engineer. Yeah. That's exactly right. What a word.
That's what you have to do what sometimes. A word. Just find a way. Just think outside the box a bit. Just lead your people to glory.
Well, we've got some very serious questions to ask Jimmy Bartel later on about the Giants because I thought they'd come out and just freewheel it and just with nothing to lose. Oh, Canelio back in the team and they don't kick a goal in the second half. And full credit to St Kilda. Yeah, full credit to St Kilda and what Brett Ratten's done this year is amazing. We'll talk about that later on as well. But oh my goodness, the Giants.
Yeah, but a little bit of oh my goodness to the Saints too, just by the way. I mean, they were fantastic. They were never in doubt. From the start of that game, they were never going to lose it the way they came out and played. So I think we need to give a little bit of love to, which we will, with Seb Ross a little bit later on, yeah, and with Jimmy. But I think I'm not sure who it says more about, I must admit. I was super impressed again by St Kilda. I like you, tipped the Giants on Friday because it was all still on the line to a degree and a chance to really go out strong. But St Kilda didn't allow them to. St Kilda were fantastic. God, they were good.
I'm wrapped. We're talking with Seb Ross later this morning. Because the question I want to ask him is now they've made the finals, but you don't want a supporter base and a playing group thinking that's the end point of making a final. That's our premiership of making the finals, all the excitement. And it was fantastic. There were great scenes in the rooms, obviously, on the Friday night to see how proud they were. But you don't want to go into a final series half and whitey just making up the numbers. And I actually think St Kilda are better than that. I think they're a better football team than just making up the numbers. But I hope they go in with that mindset of it's good enough that we made it. And if we lose, so be it. We'll come back next year. I think they have a real opportunity because they're going to play... Who are they going to play, whitey?
Probably the Bulldogs. Yeah.
If Port wins, they play the Bulldogs.
Yeah. And if Collingwood win, they play Collingwood. Both those teams against St Kilda are very winnable. Are very, very winnable for the Saints. So they've got to go in with a mindset now of, no, we're in, great, but we expect to be in. We expect to be in, now we go and win finals.
The best part about what St Kilda did was that, because I thought they would get nervous when they got that window of opportunity within the game, because it had happened previously over the last month or so. But after halftime, to kick 7 goals to the Giants, no goals, was a fantastic effort. They owned the moments in the second half. But I'm sorry, half, but for the Giants to only kick 4 goals after halftime, I think that says a lot about where they're at. That's a big story.
4 points.
Four points. That's a big story for a team that played off in last year's grand final and has been to 3 consecutive preliminary finals.
Yeah, but that's not on the weekend. You can't put that all into the last quarter of the season. They've been average all year.
That's a bigger story than just the last quarter of the weekend.
They're a bigger story, full stop.
No, 100%. But that's my point, is that's the culmination of a year's work where they've been really, really poor. And when they still had a chance to make the finals going into that second half, that's what they served up.
But it's probably better that they don't make the finals, because it would band-aid over all the problems that they've got moving forward. So now, don't make the finals, okay? A real hard review of the season and what's going on, and come out. I'm still a believer in the Giants. I still think they're... I don't like... Look, talent's not the right word. I just think when they're playing at their best, they are one of the most dangerous teams. It was few and far between this year with their performance. But I still think they can bounce next year, in my opinion. There's no doubt they can bounce.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what Jimmy says about that. By the way, a bit of feedback coming through off the SMS. Morning, boys. Royal Bowers running today at Ararat in race 7. Tomo just he is insisting on telling us about this horse running, and when he does, it never runs well. No tip, just want to let you guys know, stick with the early mail, boys. Our luck will change. That's good feedback, Tomo. That's nice, reassuring positivity. I like that. Cheers.
What about,
your man, Tomo, in Ballarat. That's a nice exit.
What about All My Life, Daniel?
Tomorrow at Kyneton, Royal Kyneton tomorrow. We scratch from Tatura.
It continues to be rescheduled. It's always rescheduled.
No, we didn't really like Tatura. Short straight for us.
Why'd you put it in there in the first place for then?
Because we needed a run sometimes. There's big fields this time of year.
Hang on, Whitey. There was conversation through the commercial break with Dean Lester on Friday.
That's right.
And Daniel was very particular about the questioning towards Dean and would the track suit All My Life.
Uh-huh.
And once Dean said, I don't think this track suits, Daniel picked up his phone straight away, and the text messages were blasted away to other owners and trainers.
Correct. All of a sudden. Mate, this place doesn't just look good, mate. There's a whole lot going on behind this.
Yeah,
it's about
not
how
so
you
sure.
position yourself. Well, let's focus on what happened to the Champs-Élysées overnight. We have crowned a new Tour de France champion. Phil Roxton has been covering it for us all campaign long. We think he's outstanding. Filthy Phil, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. We've crowned a new champion and the first Slovenian to win the race and the youngest man to win the race since Henri Cornet in 1904. Phil, tell us his name.
You know, how do you want to pronounce this? Do you want to go with the Pogacar or the Pogacar? But he certainly rode like a motorbike a couple of nights ago when he took the Tour de France win. Look, is it good for cycling to crown a new champion? And I certainly think so. Is it breaking the strain of the Ineos Sky team? Yes, it has. Has it achieved what it wanted to achieve in a COVID-ridden year? We've seen some live sport and we've seen some really dramatic stuff. You probably ticked that box as well, boys. It certainly has been a Tour de France worth remembering. Given last year to Egan Bernal, another young guy as well, ushering a new era half in cycling.
Well, we like new eras. It's a good thing to happen. But do you reckon there will be an asterisk to this Tour de France, or is it a fully legit one according to the hardcore cycling people?
Look, they've covered thousands of kilometres, over 3,000 kilometres in 21 days, time trials, mountains, you know, loose units on some of the mountains running up with all sorts of carry-on. So I think the traditional aspects of the Tour de France have been achieved. It's certainly one that, you know, is not without its controversy. Of course, cycling lives in the world of controversy. And I guess it's sort of a, like most sports these days, when you see something that is phenomenal, you are on a wait and see, and you hope that what you are seeing is the real thing. So there's been all sorts of conspiracy theories from some of the riders, and it's certainly, you know, cycling has a tainted past, but let's hope this one is a clean era.
Well, that's what we all hope, I think, when it comes to this sort of stuff. But Tadej Pogačar has become the winner of this year's Tour de France. A nice little pomp and ceremony down the Champs-Élysées as well. And we saw, and we discussed this last week, I reckon Whitey brought it up with you last week, Phil, that Richie Porte was chasing a podium. And that's all, pretty much all he had to chase in the last week or so. And he got there, became only the second Australian in history to finish on the podium of the Tour. What a performance by Richie.
It's amazing. I mean, this is the other thing, the sort of unsold story of this young guy winning the Tour. But Richie Porte has done 10 tours. He's had a fifth place as his highest result. He's had so much bad luck. I remember the times he's crashed out of the Tour or he's lost time and you think, oh my God, this guy's never going to get to where he needs to be or realise the potential. Is he a Tour de France winner? Probably not, I wouldn't have thought. But goodness, getting on a podium in the Tour de France is an epic result. And he has been such a hardcore warrior on all the teams that he's ridden on. He doesn't have the strongest team, but on Saturday night, boys, he was super strong. You couldn't have asked for a better representation of our country than this guy, because he's humble, he's quiet, and he lets his wheels do the talking. And he was phenomenal on that Saturday night. I thought his time trial was absolutely outstanding. Of course, they did the really cool bike change midway through for the last part of that climb, and he was actually third overall in that tour, in that stage, which just showed the form that he brought. And as he gets stronger in that second and third week, he just made all the right decisions. And good off to him to come to the Tour and miss the birth of his second child and get that result. It feels vindicated for him. As we know, boys, I think heads back to Ineos next year to be the super domestique for Egan Bernal. Chris Froome and the band is back together. So he's heading back, I think, to serve the last few years of his career with a big contract with a big team.
And I think it must be said that while there were a few of the big names that, that weren't participating this year, and it was obviously such a unique Tour de France, to be only the second Australian to reach the podium at the Tour de France, that is an incredible achievement. And we've all been hoping over the years that this would happen. The fact that it has happened is a stunning achievement for him.
Yeah, the fact that we were talking about an Australian rider in the third week of the Tour, I just love that. You know, the fact that we're not sort of, you know, for years we sort of relied on that green jersey with the likes of O'Grady and McEwen, et cetera. And then Cadell showed up, who is he's the greatest cyclist we've ever produced. I could, you know, stand and sit there and talk stats all day. He's the greatest, the king, the number one. And then behind him, you've got Richie Porte now, who has now climbed to the podium, which is, you know, such a significant effort. And the Australian sporting landscape is a huge, huge result for him to get up there. To fight his way through all the battles that he's had. You're absolutely right. And the maturity that he showed, the poise that he showed, and the control that he showed on that last time trial were next to none. I've never seen anything like that for a number of years. And anything that he now gives Australian cycling is that, you know, there'll be kids wanting to be Richie Porte, the kids who see him or see him race, and maybe their dads talk about him or their mums talk about him, et cetera. He's just hopefully inspiring another generation of people to get on two wheels and try cycling, and that's the sort of thing that spurs the sport on.
Jimmy, you would have been a magic! Good morning, James.
Yeah, morning, Half. I actually would rather be called a Goliath than a behemoth, to be honest.
I think
Goliath
I'm with
sounds
you.
Cooler. Goliath sounds a bit cooler.
Maybe that's our next horse name, Jim. We'll call it Goliath.
Yeah, as long as it gets around places other than just the Royal Melbourne Show getting fed carrots. That looks like, I guess, the trajectory of the horse that we're in at the moment. We've got, for people who don't know, Half and I are together with a horse, and at the moment it's trending nicely to just be at the Royal Melbourne Show for the next 10 years.
No, he's going to be a winner. Just had a bit of a mishap, in the stall, just having a bit of a spell on the back of that.
How many have you got, Half?
Too many. Don't tell Beck, for God's sake.
No, he's one of the great horse owners. He's up there, you know, when they talk. They're actually about to do a documentary. You know, every year they go into like a horse owner's background and You know, they go, they used to be tuna farmers, or they, you know, won lotto, or they bought a $150 horse. They're going to the horse empire of Daniel Harford from the leafy eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
Currently involved.
Neil Kearney.
Yeah, Neil Kearney. That's it, Rabbi. Yeah, with the voice. He's got some, he goes and eats gravel for breakfast. That kind of voice.
I'm currently involved in four. There's only two of racing age. But and he's got, currently involved in four. One of those is just having recovering from surgery. One of those is running tomorrow. So there we go. I've got a runner. And then two of those will be down the track.
And just the final bit on it, gentlemen, ours just seems to require a new horse blanket every week. I've never known a horse to wear so many different horse blankets. They keep getting a bill every Monday going, oh, you're up for another $80 for a horse blanket. And it's been gelded five times.
And there's a lot of tieback operations happening as well. He won a trial. This one won a trial at Randwick or Rose Hill, wherever it was. Oh, and with O'Hare, we're away to go. Booked in for a race on a Tuesday. I think it might have been on the Saturday. It falls over in the bloody stall after getting spooked and chips its hip. Goodness me.
Yeah.
Goodness me. We'll be right, Jim. We'll get a winner soon. We'll get him out there.
Yeah, it'll win the pony rides around Royal Melbourne. But tonight's game, guys, I was just looking at the ladder, and I think for me, if I'm St Kilda, and I think I'm really barracking for Collingwood, because I think that matchup, just at the moment, so say if Collingwood lose to Port Adelaide, the odds would say, they'd look to match up against West Coast, St Kilda v the Bulldogs. Now, I think actually the matchup the Saints would prefer would be the Pies, just because the way the Bulldogs' midfield stacks up against St Kilda's midfield, I'm just doing already preempting matchups, who would like to play who doesn't want to play who, and I think that has happened in recent finals series in the last couple of years. I almost look at it a bit like when you get the tennis open draw. You know, who doesn't want to meet who on which side of the draw leading to the finals? And I'm not saying the Saints won't back themselves in against the Bulldogs, but I just like the matchup for the Saints playing Collingwood compared to the Bulldogs with their midfield and how informed the Bulldogs' midfield are at the moment. Because I know the Freo are really brave, but you had a look at Liberatore and Hunter in the last 4 to 5 weeks, you know, coming back into the side and their form. I just think the Dogs are a pretty difficult proposition for the Saints.
Well, they are, but they might be without one of their key forwards, Jim, after Tim English. Aaron Norton. Tim English played very well. Mm. Aaron Norton went down with what is a suspected. Have we got any update on that? Suspected fractured cheekbone after a head clash with Sean Darcy in the end of the second quarter. I think it might have been last night. Yep. He certainly went for scans, Rammer. I'm not sure if there's been any update from the Dogs on that news, but if he's not there, it does make playing the Dogs, if you want to play the matchup game, a little bit more attractive.
I agree with that, but you just look at it. If you're the Saints midfield, of course you're always going to back yourself in, but you know, no side bottom, you can put steel across to whoever's running hot for Collingwood. I just don't think it's as deep as when you go Liberatore, Hunter, Bontempelli, Bailey Smith, Jack McRae against the Saints midfield.
No, that's fair.
Yeah, the Saints midfield's pretty good, Whitey. If you look at it, Zach Jones comes back into the team. Hopefully, Hanbury can play on a Lockie Hunter out on a wing. Jack Steele, well, teams need to play on Jack Steele now. Seb Ross can run with a player. They've got options. I like the Saints. I think they've done wonderful things this year.
I think what Jimmy is saying, though, is a little bit like, I reckon there will be a few clubs last night that were hoping that the Dockers beat Freo. The Dogs, because they are the dangerous wild card, because they have a point of difference. And, you know, the amount of midfielders that they've got, if they get the game on their terms, they're going to be a very dangerous team. So, because they are so different. And, you know, we talk about Norton. I'm not so sure that Aaron Norton makes a massive difference. I mean, he's kicked 14 goals for the season, Aaron, and he kicked 6 of them in one game. So, while structurally he might make them better, I don't know necessarily whether he's going to be the difference between them winning and losing games. It's going to be about their midfield dominance and the way that they play. And they've got a lot of players in good form going into a final series.
No, I can't agree with you there, Whitey, on that one. I think Aaron Norton is absolutely critical to them going into a final series. He just, you know, if that's the case, Josh Bruce hasn't been in great form, and then you're relying on Josh Bruce basically as your number one key forward. So Mitch Wallace has had a great year, obviously, but you know, he's not. You need somebody to kick to in a final.
I understand I'm saying is it not the difference between them winning or losing a final based on his output this year? I think Mitch Wallace is more of a loss to the Bulldogs if his shoulder's a serious problem than Norton in a lot of ways.
Well, I think Norton allows them to play the two speeds of footy, which I think the Dogs will need if they're going to make a deep run. And it's a bit to what Rama was saying. So we know the Dogs, when they win the footy and they go fast, you know, Daniels, Johannesson, all these sort of guys, they look super. But it's when they get slow and held up. So say if you get slow and held up on the halfback flank, this is where Norton allows you to play that, all right, let's go long down the line. He's not going to get outmarked. He either marks it or he creates a contest. And then you're almost restarting that contested style where they can all go, all right, it's going long down the line. Bontempelli, all these sort of players, you know, get to the front and square. And it's almost like a restart stoppage by kicking long down the line. So I think it allows them by having Norton because, you know, Josh Bruce hasn't been great this year. And Tim English is still trying to, I guess, work his contested marking or that positioning out still at the moment. So sort of a little bit with Rammer on that one. He just allows you to do a couple of things, Norton.
Yeah, I'm not saying he's they'd much prefer to have him out there. I'm just saying it's not the be-all and end-all for them, that's all.
All right, so that's for the Doggies. They were good in the, certainly in the last quarter. They played a really good brand of footy in the last quarter. The breeze was a bit of a factor last night against Freo. Put up a strong show, matched them around the contest, Rammer for most of the evening, but the Dogs were able to play a system that was almost old school into the wind footy. It was, we've got the ball and the umpire's got the ball. There was no real chance for Fremantle to take too much possession of the footy or have any chance to move it with any fluency when they did get possession. And interestingly, Jim, from a Fremantle perspective, when the game was on the line, they had to make something happen. They were really quite slow and went side to side as opposed to going forward and putting pressure on the Dogs' defence.
Yeah, I saw that as just as a young side who were very literal with the coaching. I think that can happen a little bit. But the positive for Freo, again, was, you know, Sarong, their young players, Chera, were all super. Like, they've even got, you know, Hughes. You go through some of these names. I think this year we've seen with some of the Freo players, we're going, oh, who's that guy who's playing down back? Or another young player jumps up at you. I think Longmuir's done a good job. I just thought, as I was saying before, it just looked like, oh, we've got stuck into our game plan, and whereas it was like, well, okay, we need to park that game plan and we've got to go for the win.
Wasn't it interesting, guys, to see, and we talked, Jimmy, a little bit about this earlier with Melbourne when they played in Cairns, but when teams are taken out of the sterile environment of a stadium where it's sort of the weather conditions are neutralised, you just play a certain way. But when all of a sudden teams are playing with 3-goal wins, rather than just one kick in your into the forward 50, they still kept trying to play, or they tried to make it a lot more complicated than what it was, or should be.
Yeah, I think what I got taught really early sort of in my career and coming through underage football is when you have conditions change, you can actually still play the same game plan, but you can actually shift or the dimensions of the ground. So what I'm trying to say is, say when it's wet, this is what always surprised me. It's very difficult to intercept mark. We all know that because the ball is wet and slippery. So that means instead of that, you know, a lot of sides, they kick long to the pocket because it's a defensive kick, but you can protect it, you know, because if you don't win it or if it gets intercepted, you're in a good spot to defend. Now, if it's wet, you can actually shift everything, your direct line attack, towards the middle of the goal. So even if you're on the centre wing, instead of kicking to the flank or the pocket, you can kick in a straight line because you can actually pretty confidently say the opposition's not going to mark the footy. So then it becomes a live ball in a good position. So it's still a safe kick because you know the opposition's going to be so difficult for them to mark the ball in the wet or very windy conditions. But what sides don't do is they're so well drilled, but going, I have to kick that ball to the flank. So a bit what you're saying there, Whitey, they're drilled under perfect conditions, but you've got to make the adjustment with the conditions going, well, I don't have to kick it to the flank because they're not going to intercept the footy. It's going to hit the ground anyway, so might as well hit the ground in a better position for us.
Yep, that makes sense. That makes sense.
It's sort of like that footy IQ being taught, going, yeah, we've learnt that, but here's the asterisk. If it's pouring rain or it's blowing a gale, go more direct.
Well, there's got to be flexibility to adapt. You have to have that in those conditions.
Yeah, I just think that, I mean, I know this is going to be too much of a simplistic example, but there was a scenario last night where the Dockers just quick kick out of the contest in the middle of the ground, and it was marked by a Fremantle player 40 metres out from goal, and they went back and kicked the goal. And you think, well, gee, that was quite easy, wasn't it? And then you see them the next time just stuffing around with 25 kicks to get to the same spot. And amazing what happens if you kick it quickly, you get a one-on-one rather than going around all over the place trying to pick apart zones to find yourself where all of a sudden the Bulldogs are set up with 14 players inside their defensive 50. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, to use a bit of an example, what I was talking about is, and I know under Chris Scott, and next time you watch the Cats, how much this happens, if we're coming off half-back on a slow possession, we'll sort of build the ball up. But he has the asterisk, which he coaches the team, which is if you win the ball directly in the middle of the ground, so say if you get a free kick or an intercept mark, say a true centre-half-back position, almost sounds old-school commentary, that true centre-half-back position, go straight up the middle. And people go, why is that? Because what Chris Scott and the coaching panel is saying is, they're going to be so well drilled to quickly zone and spread. The actual weak point is up the middle, because you can't. Otherwise, if they do just stay in the middle, well, then your free ones will become obvious wide. You watch Geelong, how many times their first kick out of a quarter goes up the middle, because the opposition always defends the outside. They get out, they zone out really wide. There's a weak spot up the middle.
And Whitey, just on that, the Bulldogs, in terms of that quick kick, being dangerous going into the opposition's forward half. I think that's the Bulldogs' Achilles heel at the moment, because Caleb Daniel plays as how he wants to. He doesn't play on an opponent. So effectively all you've got is five Bulldogs defending. So when the ball's high and long and you see Cordy or Easton Wood coming in and, you know, spoiling and creating numbers, but when the ball comes in quick and it's 1-on-1, because the Dogs' defence is scrambling to find the matchup, because they're virtually playing 5 versus 6, that's where the issue lies. So I'm an interested watch in that first week of the finals with the Dogs to see if they change that up slightly to go more 1-on-1, because those other five defenders, it puts a lot of pressure on those guys to really defend to allow Caleb Daniel to do what he wants.
Yeah, I know we're going to talk about other teams' half, but sorry, just on Lachie Hunter, his performance last night was extraordinary, and he's had a disappointing year for a number of reasons, a lot of setbacks along the way, but to stand up like he did in a game that was the most important game the Dogs have played all year, he was so far the best player on the field. He was remarkable. So I just wanted to make comment on that.
You love Lachie Hunter like no other.
No,
let's move to the Dockers, just quick, because we'll talk more about the Bulldogs through the finals, obviously, in the next couple of weeks. The Dockers, out of 10.
Last year, they had 9 wins, 9-13. So this year, what did they finish at? They finished at...
in terms of what? In the ladder?
Wins. They finished 7 wins.
Finished 12.
So I think from where...
7 wins from 17.
Oh, there is.
I think a lot of... He's back. I think a lot of people thought the Dockers were broken in terms of, with Ross obviously leaving, they thought they were broken, but they still had a Brownlow medalist, obviously, there. Their team's still reasonably well, but they've transitioned now into younger players playing through the midfield more often. So that's allowed them, Fife and Mundy and the like, to play different roles. But I think the future looks really bright. So it's a pass to me. I'd say 7, 7.5 for the Dockers this year.
Whitey, ranking?
Yeah, I reckon about a 6. About a 6. I think it's always... about a 6. You've got to remember how many games they did win last year. No, but they won a lot of games last year. And I know that it's a new coach and all that sort of thing. But, it's a hard 6, not a soft 6, but it's a 6.
7.5, man. Fantastic.
Yeah, am I back here, Huff?
You're back, Jim.
Yeah, am I back? Do you get me?
Gotcha.
All right, cool. Do you hear my rating, or was I just talking to into fresh air?
Yeah.
You gave us your rating. You cranked it from a 6 to a 7, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then you went off.
Yeah, 6 to a 7. I think they've got a lot of parts that you need for a good side. They're building a deep midfield. You get Alex Pearce back, Griffin Logue, you know, potential defenders, but they found some other young defenders as well. Ryan has been super. That's the thing. Players who have been on their list for a number of years have gotten better. Like, yep. Tabner's, you know, absolutely improved a lot. Ryan's improved. Darcy has certainly improved. So you've got a key ruckman there already, which a lot of clubs are looking for. And it just, the question is, what happens with Jesse Hogan? Does he persist with him? Michael Walters, they'll get a full season out of him next year. Hayden Young, their draftees, their three really good draftees from this year showed glimpses, and you add it to, you know, Chera and Brayshaw as well, and the others. I think a 7 for me for the Fremantle Dockers.
The beauty of the Dockers half and Whitey is they have an identity. And I think teams that finish outside the 8, you need to hang your hat on something. You need to say, okay, this is our brand, this is our style. Fremantle are clearly hard to play against at the moment. They run, and they're an intercept marking team. They're a very good intercept marking team when they get behind the football. The next element that Justin Longmuir now needs to work on is probably the attack and their ball movement. So that's they find themselves in trouble at the moment with their ball movement because they're not sure what to do with it. I think the focus clearly has been, let's defend, let's be hard to play against. But now the next layer to that becomes ball movement. But they've got an identity.
For a long time, we've had a group of players that don't turn up their toes when things aren't going well. And I think all the good sides over, at least the modern era, have had that trait. It doesn't guarantee you anything going forward. Still, I think if we play that way, we're not going to be able to compete with the very best teams. But it gives you a chance if certain things don't go your way early. You know that there's the strength of character and will to keep persisting. I think we have that.
We're going to need it for a finals campaign. Chris Scott there, coach of the Cats, talking about his strength and will of his players. They were challenged by the Swans yesterday, very much so. From the very start of the game, in fact, they were under enormous pressure, but like good teams do, kept grinding and kept finding a way, ended up winning by 6 points, but dramatic late there for the Swans. Thought there might have been a bit of a show by the Swannies. Jimmy didn't agree with me yesterday, but the Cats were too good in the end, and they now finish in fourth position. They will take on, depending on the result tonight, if Port Adelaide win, they'll take on the Pair, and if Port Adelaide lose, they'll take on the Brisbane Lions. Jim, any concerns from what you've seen for the Cats, or just tuning up nicely for a finals campaign?
Well, it wasn't a nice tune-up. I was proven to be right with you. I said the Cats would win, and again, I was right again, half in front of you. So you mark that one down as another wrong one for you. And again, another issue for your form ladder, which has been binned because Melbourne didn't make the 8.
No,
so it's been
front.
A bad weekend for you, half.
We're still in
but,
front.
In all seriousness...
They can still make it, Jim. We're still hanging on, Jim. We're still a chance.
That's right, a COVID breach could just come around the corner. they're wishing for a COVID breach. But look, I sort of saw this game against the Swans a bit like the Tigers a couple of weeks ago against, well, not a couple of weeks, a couple of rounds ago. They're rounds, I've heard you say that half correctly. They're rounds,
right,
not weeks.
Yes.
But a couple of rounds ago when the Tigers played the Dockers, when you know you're sort of the better side and you've got enough in the tank, 5 minutes of football here and there, but... it just proved to be enough. And where the Swans, actually, I think for the Cats, they're concerned. The Swans' uncontested possession and their willingness to handball and keep the ball alive, which shifted Geelong's defence and actually made Geelong's midfield and small forwards and those flanker types actually spend more time defending than they're used to in recent weeks, which burns a lot of energy. It's very, very tough to keep running to defend. They kept the ball live, the Swans, they spread Geelong. And we spoke about this last week with the Cats. If you can spread them across the ground, you get them really flat in defence. So, if you had the camera angle from the wing, you'd see Geelong's defence very high and flat. You can beat them sort of out the back with a bit of speed and, ball movement. And I think the Swans did that well early in the game. But it just looked like the Cats, they knew it was finals as much as you... you know, you shake your finger and you want them to be ruthless at the end. They've been fantastic all year. They knew they were playing finals. Maybe the double four chance, you know, became a reality after halftime, and you heard Chris Scott really, you know, seem frustrated at halftime. But, you know, 11 top four finishes in the last 14 years for the Cats, it's an extraordinary effort.
All right, I'm going to ask to put the three of you under the microscope here, and I'll start with you, Rama. Microsoft. Mm. It's a Microsoft brand of microscope. So based on what... A couple of weeks ago, we thought Geelong were bulletproof. We thought that they were, you know, the flag favourites and they had no chink in the armour. But based on what you've seen over the last couple of weeks, is there reason to change your mind? I'll start with you, Rama.
No.
Well, Jimmy's going
to
Rama.
No, I still think the they're fine. I think the Cats they'll play in a prelim final. The Cats from there, it's anybody's guess. But I think they'll get to. I think they'll definitely get to the prelim.
Half.
Yeah, no, I'm with Rama. I think they're a prelim team, and then from there, it's the toughest weekend in footy to win. So we'll see, but. Nothing changes for me. They're more than capable. They are still the team that I believe has the are the best at changing modes, and it can adapt to any situation.
Yeah. My one fear for the Cats, Whitey, is when they get into slow tempo football, they can't score.
Yes,
they
right.
just they simply can't score. They don't know how to. They don't know actually when they're in slow play to actually take the ball forward. They take it sideways a lot and sort of just edge backwards, and then it's a kick down the line, and then usually, well, then it's, you know, then it's a 50-50 situation. I'd be a lot more confident in slow play they could score more. Their most important probably player through the final series, and he needs to average probably 2 to 3 goals a game, is Gary Rowan, just to give Hawkins a chop out.
Yeah. I reckon... This is just my view, is Geelong's biggest threat is themselves in a final series in a lot of ways, because they can outsmart themselves. That's just my view. Now, another question for the three of you. Gary Ablett said this was going to be his last year. Now, this year almost doesn't count. He's hardly played and, you know, we saw what he could do off no preparation yesterday. He's still a very important player for Geelong inside 50. Could you convince him to play again?
According to his dad, it might be everyone's last year, so we're in trouble anyway. Well, am I right or not? Is that what he said? Yes.
Well, that's what he said. He did say that. So I'll start with you, Jimmy, here, because you know him well.
Mm.
Is that a good idea or a bad idea? He used to say, well, hey, Gary, you've hardly played, mate. Your body's still okay.
I'd be working on him to play, and you just, it's the way you structure the contract. You say, look, we don't need you to play every single game. We call it a 14, 15 games. If you feel good and play more, yeah, we'll give you bigger match payments, all that sort of stuff. You know, come back in January, you know, end of January, do your pre-season. Then he's super professional how he gets himself ready every year. He doesn't miss games of footy apart from that shoulder collarbone where McCaffrey pretty much sunk the entire Gold Coast for 3 years in one tackle. he pretty much ruined a franchise, McCaffrey, with that tackle. But he's still... This is what always been my frustration when the negativity came with Gary, is that people go, oh, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that. That's the point he got to his career. He's got so good that people just focus on the negative. Now, if you look at what he still does well, he still kicks the ball better than 99% of players in the game. He still understands the game. He still wins one-on-ones. He still hits the scoreboard, and he can find the footy. He still, if you play him at half forward, he's in a, call it the full season mode. He's still a 30-goal, 20-possession game player. Now, how many of them are in the competition?
Correct.
So why would he need to be convinced?
Well, I don't get why, just because of his age. His age, we just go, whoop, line through him because he's this age.
I agree.
I didn't realise we were at development.
This wasn't age, Jim. This was him. He said he was out.
No, but you just go to him, this is what you're telling him. Go, mate, you're still great. You're not damaging legacy or whatever it may be. If we get halfway through the year and you go, right, your body packs in, that's okay. Well, I don't get what's the... Like, what, you're going to just play someone who's untried at the level or can't do the things he can do? I think there's real fear of people going, oh, you know, it doesn't work out halfway through the year. I don't see why that's so negative. Like, you're better off trying with one of the greats, aren't you?
Yeah, but he might want to play.
Well, that's
no, he's going to play. I'm telling you, Gaz, you're playing.
I'd love to see him play to his 50, personally. I look at the goal that he kicked yesterday and how he was able just to slice through, use his pace. So his pace is still clearly there. My question, and this is what Geelong will be asking themselves, is there somebody that's on the fringe of the team that's going to produce the same numbers and the same output as Gary as that forward, as he's been playing?
Yeah, and further that, Rama and Whitey, is especially now when you... It's a bit different if you were, you know, a side like Freo, for example, where there's so many young guys coming through. It's a different lens you're looking at it. But while you've got Hawkins, who'll be 32, Coleman medalist, you've got Selwood, who's 31, 32, you've got Dangerfield, 31-ish, Harry Taylor, who's 68. Like, while you've got that window of these champions at the end, like, you can't then replace him with someone who's going to take 2 to 3 years.
We'll see what Gary does.
I mean, I mean, he said that it was going to be his last year, but I think he should play on personally. And it wasn't a normal year. His body is still fresh enough to potentially go again. And we saw on the weekend, it wasn't just the goal he kicked. He set up 3 or 4 others. Geez, inside 50, he's a bloody dangerous player still.
He's a champion. He always has been, always will be. We need to move on. Other teams in town. Let's talk about... I want to ask you three gentlemen a question. Why can't you play Party Time footy through the regular season? Hawthorn did it yesterday. The first time we've seen them...
Coaches don't allow it.
We've seen them... We saw them play a brand of football that was actually quite attractive. It was actually quite exciting. Now they played the Gold Coast Suns, who are running out of gas a bit. So there's a caveat there a little bit. But why can't... Where have those blokes been? Rama, where have those blokes been?
Yeah, no, I know. No, it's, look, we speak about this week in, week out, half. It's probably the frustrating point. When the shackles are released on most teams, they do know how to move the ball. They do know how to score. They do know how to play with flair and dash and dare. So... But again, we speak about this every week. You know, the AFL football is becoming a little bit more like the NBA. Get it down to the last quarter and be in the game and then try to go from there. But I'm still a firm believer in do your work early. You know, do your work early in the game and release the shackles when players are at their best from a physical point of view. When you get into a last quarter, players are tired. They're tired, so mistakes continue to happen. If you do it early in the game, you know, it's very hard to catch a team now, particularly in shorter quarters. Very, very difficult to catch a team.
Jim, why can't they play Party Time footy? Who's going to have the courage to play Party Time footy?
Well, because coaches are control freaks and they're risk adverse. They'd rather coach knowing what exactly is going to happen because they're the experts in the field and the players executing their game plan and executing their coaching career, to be honest. It's, do you know what? I'll get a safer result if Ramanauskas, who's on the halfback flank, if he kicks that 15 metres up the line, no, that's not an issue. I won't get scrutinised. But if Rama pulls the trigger, kicking it up through the middle on a 35-metre kick and turns it over, and we get scored against, ooh, hang on a minute, I might have another loss to my name. But well, I spoke about this last week. If that actually becomes a predictable model of football, it's actually not that risky. Because if everyone knows once we get to, you know, half back or the Toyota logo's on the wing, they start moving there and movement happens. And you know what? You can actually make a lot of errors because... It's predictable. You can play high-risk football, but it can be predictable.
Whitey, this conversation that we're having now is the perfect reflection of the Essendon-Melbourne game on Saturday. So, you know, the first quarter was a little bit of sort of dancing with your sister, and then the second quarter, Melbourne start to play. They start to run, they start to carry, they start to dash, they kick 5-0 in that second quarter. The fourth quarter, Essendon got nothing to lose, last quarter of the season, throw all caution to the wind. they start kicking goals. I think it was 5-2 or 5-3 in Essendon's favour in that last quarter. Melbourne in the end had to release the shackles again to score twice in that last quarter through ball movement. So that game, the Essendon Melbourne game, is almost a perfect reflection of this conversation.
Yeah, so but we've said it 16 times this year about Essendon. We said it 16 times about Essendon this year that their best football was played when they got 5 or 6 goals down and they had to play fast. But that's you could say the same about 3 or 4 different teams.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the coaches are trying to bring control to an area of the game where they feel like they don't have the most control. So, like, with stoppages, you can at least control a bit of time, you can get set up. So they can go, you know, look, we'll play this sort of setups. We have this sort of look behind the ball, this sort of look in front of the ball. Now, when they look at score sources, you know, they either come really pretty much from free kicks, stoppages, turnovers. So what they're trying to do is get complete, as much control as they can get from free-flowing football. And that sounds weird. It sounds like a contradiction. But if you can get field position and slowness, speed and territory, then you're trying to reduce the amount of scores against from your turnovers. Yep. So it's just, again, it's a control thing.
Control thing, that's what they do. So the Gold Coast GM,
You do it half. You're the coach
of
this group.
All of you.
What? All of you. I'm going to bomb a Thompson you. All of you. Why do you do it with your bucket hat on?
Because we dominate proceedings. I'm going to get a number from you for Gold Coast and Hawthorn, Jim, first. Out of 10.
Gold Coast, 6. 6. I think they finished the year game poorly, but we saw enough. I think we saw the game style. It was actually a lot better. Look at their percentage. I know, Rama, you like to look at percentage as a reflection on your season. It was much, much better. I think there's a lot more character in this group of Gold Coast Suns. I think they still fight it out, grind it out, which has been a big positive for me. I think a 6 is probably fair for Gold Coast.
Rama? Gold Coast percentage last year was 60. This year, their percentage finishes at 90. So it's part of the reflection, but I think, again, Gold Coast changed as a football. They won 3 games last year. They won 5 games this year, albeit, again, what Gold Coast need to really focus on through the off-season and pre-season is just continuing to build the resilience through the team. They start seasons well. They started the season a bit longer this year where they, you know, obviously we had the COVID break, but they were better to start the season. But then they, again, once it gets to the grind of later in the season, that's when they just start to drop off. So continuing to build resilience into the playing group moving forward will be a big thing for Gold Coast.
Righto, Whitey?
I give Hawthorn a 2. They were terrible. They are so much better than that. They were terrible. They completely lost their way when they went in the hub. And for whatever reason, that was the case. And I think it was almost an indictment on their season, the way that they played at times there on the weekend, that they were capable of doing that. I'm not as bullish about Gold Coast. They won once since round 7. I think that needs to be made clear, once since round 7. So, yeah, 3 for them.
That's 3. That's one more than they won the previous 3 years.
5 for Gold Coast, 3 for the Hawks for me. Scott Pendlebury there, who tonight breaks the Magpies all-time games record, an all-time games captain record as well. And speaking of lots of games and captain of the Magpies, Nick Maxwell is one of those. Will be remembered forever as the 2010 Premiership captain of the Pies. He joins us on the line this morning. Good morning, Maxi.
G'day, Half. G'day, boys.
Great to have you with us on game day too for you guys. You've got the power tonight, of course. But Pendles, you handed the reins over to Scott Pendlebury. You would have known up at that time that he was the right man to lead the footy club. But has he even exceeded your expectations about how unbelievably consistent and magnificent he's been through his AFL career?
Oh, certainly as a player, you think at some stage he's going to have a string of bad performances, but it just doesn't seem to happen. I mean, you see it with all great players. They can't do it every single week, but this guy, I think it's 10 or 11 years he's finished in the top three in the best and fairest, and to have that level of consistency is just unbelievable. And probably for me, the thing that I've loved watching the most is his development as a leader. I think when we sort of handed the reins over, he was the best player in the team, and the leadership stuff was what he had to work on. And I think that watching that evolve over the years has been something I've been really proud of him, the way he's gone about that and the way he's continued to give to his teammates and help his teammates make them better. So that's whether it be grabbing someone, doing weight in the gym with them, doing extra touch with someone, whether it's just going for a coffee with them, or obviously out in the field bringing others into the game. So he's certainly been outstanding, and his growth's been huge.
Yeah, he's taken all before him. What makes him great? Maxie, give us an insight into how he operates, how he ticks.
I just think everything he does, he wants it to be absolute elite, like the highest possible standard. So if he's doing a training session and he misses the handball or misses the kick, he makes sure he follows that up and nails that the next time round. And he won't sort of, he wouldn't leave the track unless he'd made sure he'd got everything right and ticked every box. I think even with his watching vision of the opposition and seeing what they're going to do and how they play, he wants to make sure that he knows exactly what they're doing and what they might throw at him. Even when you look at his diet, like his diet is unbelievable, the way he eats, and you can see how chiseled he is. It's so impeccable and elite with everything he does. So I just think his standards are probably across the board as high as I've ever seen.
Maxie, what about the person that he is? Because he's not that sort of in your face on social media. You don't see him doing double spread articles in the paper or, you know, on TV very much. But what about him as a person? Clearly, he's a driven person, but away from the field, how is he?
Yeah, he's obviously he's very popular with his teammates, and I think that what you probably don't see is that bit of a larrikin inside to him. You only see the real serious side public.
Oh, no. Oh,
he's take the pee out of himself.
Sorry, mate, you just dropped out there. You're back. It's cool.
Yeah, he's happy to I guess, be the butt of the jokes, but also he's happy to have plenty of jokes and make sure he stitches up teammates with pranks and stuff. So that side of him you don't really see unless you're inside the bubble. But, yeah, that's certainly a part of his life. But we'd love to see it publicly so that everyone else can see that part of him. But I think he likes that serious side a little bit too much in a public sense. So it would be nice to bring that out. We'll see what we can do.
It's a bit late.
Yeah. Now, usually when we're talking a player that, you know, breaking games records and breaking most games as captain, we're talking about that player almost coming to the end of their career, but it still feels like that he's got a number of seasons left in him.
100%. And I think that when you look at him and the way he plays, probably the thing, if I'm picturing Scott Pendlebury playing a game of footy, he just seems to find space and time slows down around him. Everyone else slows down and he just makes decisions that brings people into the game. So he doesn't rely on speed. He doesn't rely on agility. He doesn't rely on high flying or anything like that. He just relies on being able to get to a position and read what the opposition are doing and how they're moving around him and buys himself space. So I think because of that and because he's been so impeccable with the way he's looked after his body, I think he'd certainly go for three or four more years, which would be great to see because, as I said, he brings other people into the game and his knowledge out in the really important for our footy club.
I've got two questions for you, Nick, about Scott. What did you think when he first moved into Collingwood? Because he sort of vaulted up late in the draft, in sort of the latter part of his under 18 year, that he was this basketballer that turned to football and then all of a sudden became this very skillful footballer and then found himself in the top five in the draft. What do you think when he first arrived at the club?
Yeah, he came through with Dale Thomas. I think Daisy was picked two and Pendles was picked five, and Daisy was sort of that ball of energy, life of the party, and he just kicked, I don't know what he kicked, but he kicked a heap of goals and I think his best on ground in the grand final of TAC Cup. So it was a very public, person in terms of the way he went about it and very in your face. So Pendles was complete opposite. So we didn't see much of him. And in that first year, he also got glandular fever and he was knocked out for a large percentage of that year. So we didn't really see much of him or see that development. And then as he came in that next year, that's probably when we started to actually go, oh, hang on, he does one or two little nice things. You know, okay, that looks all right. And hope we can see a bit more of that. And then there's a little bit more and then there's three or four the next time. He just kept building on it and kept improving. So I think at the same time, his confidence started growing and having at the time Buckley and Burns and those quality midfields around him meant that he could actually grow in those roles and he could learn from those guys who were I guess, around the footy a lot to feed out to him, and he could actually be a bit more of an outside player as he grew as a player before he could be a player. So it wasn't an overnight sensation like, I guess, Daisy was a little bit more, but, yeah, obviously his growth's been huge in that position.
Seb Ross, now, he played his first game in 2012 for the St Kilda Football Club. He's now vice-captain. And 2012 was the year after they last played finals, of course, until this year in 2020. Yep. And now he gets a chance to be a part of what I'm sure he's always dreamed about with St Kilda in 2020. They've made the finals. I'm sure the vice-captain's very happy about that. Seb, good morning.
Good morning, guys, and I certainly am happy this morning.
You've been waiting a while, Seb, to get to this point. How does it feel?
It's just I'm just really excited, to be honest. It was a great night, Friday night, to actually secure a spot and not have to sort of wait all weekend and hope that Melbourne didn't win by too much and see what happened in the Doggies game. But a big relief, really, as well. I suppose it's been such a challenging year. Myself and the whole footy club have really knuckled down and thought we could give it a red hot crack this year. So to see the results happen and lock up a spot with all the staff that are up here and sacrificing a lot as well, it's a real relief and we're really proud.
So, Seb, how do you separate that emotion, obviously, of being so proud and excited and you've made the finals to now, okay, we've got a job to do. This is, you know, what we want to be as a football club now moving forward, not just qualify for a final series and, you know, go out and lose in a couple of weeks' time easily. You want to be a football club now that plays finals regularly. How do you separate that emotion as a leader for the rest of the playing group?
Well, I think there is just that that underwriting sense that, well, the job's definitely not finished. We sort of put in the work and got the job done to secure a spot in the finals, but now we've just got a starting position on the grid. And there's real sense and real belief in this group that we have nothing to fear. A lot of the teams that will end up being in the eight, we've either beaten this year or gone really close to. So, from our standpoint, there's a real belief in this group, and I think coming into the finals with a really good win, and it felt like it really clicked last Friday night against GWS. So certainly the job's not finished from our end, and that's the way we're treating it. So we've been fortunate to play Friday night and know that we've locked up a spot. So we've been able to have an enjoyable weekend, and once we get stuck in the training, it'll be all systems go and see what the result happens tonight, whether we're playing the Bulldogs or Collingwood. And then, I think just that belief that the group have it should hold us in good stead.
There was a risk associated with playing Dan Hannebery on Friday night. Obviously, the risk has paid off, but how close was it? Because realistically, he was pitched to play in the elimination final in a couple of weeks' time. Why was the decision made to play him on Friday night rather than wait another couple of weeks?
I think the main thing, the main decision making was about, like, will he help us win? And the main reason we got someone like Hannah's stature to the footy club is because they have that finals experience and they bring that leadership at this time of the year. So he'd done all the work that was required, and got his body and stuff in really good shape. So it really just come down to will he help us win a game of footy, and so that's why the decision went his way, and he was able to really contribute, and most importantly, get through the game and get some confidence in his body. But it was good to have him back out there, and he certainly adds a different dimension to our midfield.
Seb, congratulations on making it. As Half said, you've been around the footy club a long time now. To taste finals, I'm really pleased for you personally. I just want to know, when did you think you had it? You had the team that could make finals? You've obviously been hovering around now for a few years, but was there a game where you sort of walked off and thought, "Yep, I reckon we're a finalist this year"?
I think it was sort of when we sort of started dreaming of it was when. We'd had a five-day break. All this was certainly for me. When we had a five-day break, we'd travelled over to Adelaide and beaten Adelaide and had to go back there the following Saturday and play against Port, who were flying at the time and on top of the ladder, and to grind out a win in enemy territory was when I probably thought, gee, we could actually be there at the pointy end of the year this year, and that's probably what it was. A great stepping stone for our group to sort of garner that belief, and there was all sorts of things happening. Like I'd never, in my nine seasons, I'd never won a game over in Adelaide, so won there twice in 2 weeks, and then the following week we play Sydney, and I'd never beaten Sydney either, so then we got over them. So we're ticking off a few little milestones throughout the year, but I think all in all, our form hasn't wavered. We've had a few disappointing losses, but we've been right in every single game, whether we've won them or lost them. So I think with the recruits we got, what the club did, the work the club did over the last off season to get those guys into the club, it felt like we had a really good pre-season, and our team completely changed its dynamics. So I knew we were certainly going to be quite threatening this year, and to be here now, it's great.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.